Hello and welcome to La Pausa Pod International Break Edition. We decided to give it a couple of days before we jump back in here. We needed time to digest all the transfer news at the end of the market, the end of the window, and to have a think about what happened over the first 4 weeks of the season. But now it's down to real business as the Champions League kicks off. During the international break, Spain beat Georgia 7-1 and Cyprus 6-0. So how has your international break been, Jamie? I assume you completely switched off and didn't think for 1 second about football, yeah?
I would say no, I didn't switch off. I actually like the international break because there's no real necessity to follow games, so I don't feel compelled. And I always like to dip into Segunda and just catch up with what's going on there. Some interesting games. I don't know if you saw the Mirandés-Andorra game where Mirandés were 3-1 up going into added time. Andorra made it 3-3 and then Mirandés scored to make it 4-3 in the 98th minute. And then Edis Arabi just went completely insane in his press conference. It was one of the most entertaining press conferences I've seen in Spanish football. There were no complaints about referees or anything. He just completely destroyed his players.
Yeah, I don't know if I'm going to watch that, or no, I will watch it, but I don't know whether I'm watching it thinking, wow, this is going to be a tactical battle, or if it's just going to be complete mayhem. And it's funny that Sarabia did that, because just over the international break, just before the international break, Quique Setién was fired by Villarreal, and obviously Eder Sarabia and Quique Setién have that history together, and a report came out in Relevo, and it's been reported elsewhere since about just how bad it got between the players and the management, and how stubborn Setién was, and how toxic the environment had become. And I guess maybe looking at it in hindsight, you can see that was the case. It wasn't really evident, like it wasn't an explicit signs of discontent, but you could just see that the players they looked a little bit off, I guess, and Setién too on the bench. Sometimes you'd see him just sitting there kind of sulking, and you wonder, was that just the way he is, or was he annoyed with the players or that? But I guess he kind of could tell that this is not going in the right direction. And in the end, Pacheta comes in to pick up where Setién left off. Well, hopefully he doesn't pick up where he left off. He does a lot better than what happened in the first 4 weeks of the season for Villarreal. But that's a really, really good squad. We'll get into the international break right now. We hadn't planned on talking about this, but how do you see that appointment going?
It seems like they're trying to really tap into squad management again and have a strong relationship between the coach and the players. I don't know if you've seen any of the videos of Pacheta coming in his first talks to the players and stuff, but he's just not to say that Setién is not a nice guy. I'm a big Setién sympathizer. So, but yeah, Pacheta's character, he's a guy who's come up really in Spanish football the hard way. He's known as an absolute workaholic who really gives everything to his players, and he's just so committed. So I think from the jump, Pacheta's character is going to fit nicely with Villarreal, and then from there we'll see how his playing style develops and all those more technical things.
Yeah, 100%. I did some work with Pacheta a while ago and saw him kind of behind the scenes a little bit, and he's just, the only word to describe him really, he's so optimistic about his players, about his style of play, and he was talking about like injecting the players with his positivity. So I think when you look at the appointment, it's a bit kind of strange, and Pacheta just got railed by Adelaide. No, he didn't get them relegated, but was the manager who oversaw most of that season when they did get relegated. And you're thinking, this is Villarreal, they're in Europe. Is Pacheta failing upwards here? But then when you look at it from that point of view, this team needs positivity. They need something optimistic, because it had just become so toxic under Setién that they need that. But talking about optimistic and positivity, Spain couldn't really have done a whole lot more during the international break. They, as I said, beat Georgia 7-1 and Cyprus 6-0. And it looks, we have been, and I think it's just been the general criticism of Spain, is that they're not direct enough, don't hurt teams enough, lots of possession, lots of stale possession. But this effort under De La Fuente is possession. They're a lot of possession with purpose, playing wingers. Lamine Yamal came in, and you've been impressed with him. We'll speak about him. But overall, it looks like Spain have evolved into a far more dangerous side.
Yeah. In these types of games, you know, not so long ago, you would tune into a game against Georgia or Cyprus and think, this is going to be pretty slow. They're just going to shift the ball around and eventually find a gap. But watching this version of the Spain team, they get into attacks a lot more quicker. They're not content to just shuffle the ball around with their midfielders. Again, they were playing directly into the wingers first time from centre-backs and putting them on the back foot. Even when the opposition are really sat in, they still found ways to really get them in motion and move them around. So I don't know about you. I still don't really know what to think about De La Fuente as a manager and as an individual, but from what he's told us about how he wants his team to play, there's not too much to nitpick about this last international break in particular.
Yeah, the players are there, and I guess that's always been the issue with Spain, was how they deal with the better sides and how they... Because Luis Enrique's tenure was really good, but then they fell and at critical moments. And I mean, that's... I don't think anyone's doubting really Spain's talent. And yeah, with a couple of players we pinpointed, for example, like Rodri, and he's just so important to this team and to Man City. And his stature has grown under De La Fuente. He's the player who has played the most minutes under De La Fuente, 552 now. And bringing in Lamine Yamal, Nico Williams looks more dangerous than he does in an Athletic Bilbao shirt, I think, maybe. Gaya, who I thought was really good, played a slightly understated role against Cyprus, not moving forward as much as he does sometimes with Valencia, but kind of tucked in a little bit infield, and did damage from there. That ball over the top for the first goal, for example, and I thought he was excellent. I think they're doing everything that they possibly can, and they've been convincing. But it's going to be the bigger games that will really test their mettle. But they do look a little bit more content with a slight bit more chaos by losing the ball in higher up the field than they would have under previous management. And that means it's a slightly bit more chaotic, but they're accepting of that, and they've kind of pre-planned for that so that then when Cyprus did break and Cyprus were limited, but they were far more secure. Gaia, defensively good, players like that. So yeah, I think it's kind of hard to judge based on the quality of the opposition, but they're doing everything that they can.
Yeah, the word that came to mind when I was watching them this previous international break was they just feel like a bit more of an all-terrain team. So you've got guys like in midfield, they were pretty much a 4-4-2 out possession, even though they didn't spend too much time without possession in this game. And you've got a midfield two of Marino and Rodri, which is absolutely solid and totally different to, you know, the pure defending with the ball that we've seen from Spain over many years. This feels like a really functional team with players who perhaps in a previous time wouldn't have got an opportunity with Spain because they weren't, you know, pure passers, you know, technically perfect. Marino is a guy who's played quite a lot under De La Fuente so far, and he's like the epitome of it. He's box to box, really intense, just capable of playing in pretty much any environment. Of course, not quite as good as the interiors we're used to for Spain, but I feel like he's somebody through which you can see De La Fuente's idea for this team.
And one of the players who kind of encapsulates a lot of what you just said, and we might as well move straight into this. So that's Spain doing everything they can to right now under De La Fuente, and certainly in that international break anyway. And we're going to move on to Champions League side. So obviously Spain have La Liga has five teams competing in the Champions League after Sevilla won the Europa League last year. So they've got Barcelona, Real Madrid, Real Sociedad, Atletico Madrid, and Sevilla, the five teams. Barcelona play Real Betis and Antwerp, but back they play Real Betis and Antwerp in the next in their next two games. And coming back to that point about the players who aren't maybe as good technically, one player who I was so impressed with, and I've been watching him really closely because I asked a question on a previous pod, is Gabby a genius or is he just completely winging it? And I was watching him against Cyprus, and if you look at him, he dictates a lot of, maybe not dictates, but he definitely knows where the ball needs to go. He's far more cerebral than his style would lead you to believe. He's chaotic, he fouls a lot, he's involved in a lot of duels, but he knows where he needs to be. And one of the questions that we got when we sent out a call for Q&As is Frankie de Jong, his monopoly on touches and what that means. And I wanted to ask you, Jamie, and because it's something that I don't really know and I have to find this out. But so Gundogan looks like he's injured now, and Barcelona are optimistic about his recovery, but we don't know how much game time he's going to miss. He's played basically all of the games in the first four game weeks. He came off at the end of Getafe and he came off at the end of the Villarreal game. But what happens when he's gone? So on the point about positional play and Gabby, is he a positional play genius or is he just winging it? Can you both play positional play and not? Because this is the point. Frankie de Jong's monopoly of touches is fine if that's the style that you're aiming for. I mean, having Frankie de Jong on the ball a lot isn't a bad thing. The problem is when he has a lot of the ball, when you're trying to play positionally, because he is very kind of instinctual, and positional play is probably the opposite of instinctual. It's fixed. You move here when the ball goes there, and when he comes here, blah, blah, blah. What happens if Gundogan's injured now? Does Frankie get more touches? Does Gabby drop deeper to play in a positional play sense?
Yeah, I guess it's there's one thing what you would like to see, and then the other is what I think Xavi will go for, which is we nicked this graphic from Albert Blair, Sensat, the Spanish journalist, which is what I think is Xavi's best option from now. So the team would be Balde, Christensen, Koundé, Cancelo at right back, but playing quite central, you know, inverted and opening the flank up for Lamine. And then four midfielders of Romeu, De Jong, Gavi, and then João Félix in the Gundogan role, with, of course, Yamal out wide. And you could debate this. I'm not sure I would drop Lewandowski just yet, but I fully agree that Ferran deserves his opportunity. He's up front in this case. And I think, I just see this as the selection of players and roles that is best placed to take or to extract the most of the form that these players are in. We just mentioned Ferran there. He's been very productive.
We're talking about what you'd like to see, and I agree that Ferran needs this chance. And I mean, coming on at the end of games and influencing the games is a very different thing than starting games and being effective against lower blocks, against teams that are fresher. And Ferran needs to build his confidence back up. And there definitely is a player there. Man City didn't buy the player who he looked like he was going to become a while ago, and players talking about him being connected to the Spanish team because of Luis Enrique and stuff like that, and a little bit unfair on him, but he hasn't been good. He's better than that, but at the same time, Lewandowski is not getting dropped, I don't think.
Yeah, I don't think so either, because for Xavi it will then transform into something big, you know, if they drop Lewandowski, last season's top scorer.
Yeah.
But yeah, just on the 11 that we mentioned, I think if Xavi did, or if he was open to moving away from Lewandowski, not full time, but just to see where Ferran's at as a starter, this would be quite an unpredictable lineup for the opposition in terms of defending them, because there's lots of movement there. To have Ferran as the number nine makes a really dynamic side, and his second goal against Cyprus, that movement from outside to in was brilliant. We always say, you know, Ferran moves well without the ball, but just the timing of that run and the creativity and you know, just being able to mix it up a lot was impressive, and that's what he'll offer if he does get a chance. We did start by talking about Gavi, but I think we got off track there. But
yeah, no, yeah. I think, do you know what? I was just thinking here, and I'm looking at this team, and I'm looking at the storylines, and the players involved. Barcelona right now are one of the most interesting teams in Spain, definitely. And not just because they're Barcelona, but because what does João Felix do? Because Ferran Torres, I don't think João Felix can come in and start if Ferran doesn't. I think Ferran has earned that. Lewandowski's out of form. Does he drop him? And there's another point that you brought up, and it's really, really, really important here, because I spoke before about Lamine Yamal and him taking Rafinha's place, but Rafinha was suspended at the time, and I had kind of half forgotten that. I just pretended like I didn't, but I was speaking as if, oh, he'd taken his place, but Rafinha was suspended. Right, now, Lamine Yamal, does he start? Because if he does start, you feed into that Barcelona burnout narrative, Pedri, Ansu Fati, etc., etc. That's if he does start. If he doesn't start and things don't go right, Xavi didn't back the kid from the academy. Like, Xavi can't really win here, but they've got two really important games here, and there's talk that they're not underestimating Antwerp. Antwerp, I was just looking at their form, they're sitting like eighth in the Belgian league, not going great. It's a really good chance to try this formation. It'll surprise them. There's enough talent to beat Antwerp on the field there. Like, there's so many storylines here going on that my head's actually starting to spin.
Yeah, exactly that though with Yamal. I saw quite a lot of tweets during this past week saying, oh, Barcelona, here we go again. They're about to kill another 16-year-old and put him out of action in the same way that they've done with Pedri. But I mean, what is the answer? He's playing really well. He's showing that he can contribute from the off. Xavi's not in the business of, you know, thinking about tomorrow. It's Barcelona, and they have to win every week. Xavi always speaks about how demanding it is and all the noise that surrounds it. And the great news is that Yamal looks like a sensational player, even when everybody told us that this kid was the next Messi or whatever. He came in with, you know, that billing, and he looks about as good as you could possibly hope a 16-year-old would at this point. And then there's the other side of it, which is he's gone away for 2 weeks with Spain. He's coming back to Barcelona with a pretty massive reputation now. Everybody knows this guy. If he just goes back to Barcelona and sits on the bench behind Rafinha and that stays in place, then, you know, that's a huge story. I don't think that's going to happen, but it's a delicate balance now for Xavi to weigh up a player they paid, what was it, 50, 60 million for last season, and this wonder kid that everybody wants to see play.
And Rafinha would have a case for, he's been sort of quite effective when he has played, and there was a while there last season where Barcelona were relying on him a lot with assists and stuff, and I think he would rightly feel a little bit hard done by. But we're going to move on now, because that Barcelona situation is just incredible. Like, Cancelo, he's obviously going to change the entire dynamic of that right wing. They haven't played with a right back in so long. Playing Koundé out there, his nose was out of joint out there, playing Araujo out there, playing with a false fullback. it's just crazy. Brought in Romeo, lost Busquets, De Jong has been, that needs to get sorted out in terms of what the roles are, and that might change over the season. But yeah, I think the more we talk about this, the more we have to just sit down and maybe even do a two-part series on a two-part episode on this and get to the bottom of just everything around Barcelona so that we can get our heads properly around it. Moving on to another team that is just as much pressure on Barcelona as there is on this team, giving it away, Real Madrid, who play Real Sociedad at home. The fixture makers weren't all that kind to them. And Union Berlin, we're going to preview the Union Berlin podcast with a special guest on the podcast next Tuesday. But Real Sociedad, we can talk in depth about this. They are coming off a victory against Granada, and they've looked a lot more attacking in their opening 4 weeks. What Vinicius is out. We got a question on Twitter about the sticking with the diamond. Should they switch back? Obviously, part of why Real Sociedad have gotten better in an attacking sense, or what they're trying to evolve into, is having their fullbacks attack more. They obviously signed Tierney from Arsenal, and they've got Traore at right back, who's been excellent, and we've been a big fan of him. What do Real Madrid alter their approach for this game, or do they just keep going with what they're doing?
I don't think they'll alter their approach, no. I guess Joselu is likely to come in the diamond, but once Joselu is in there, I think it's not that difficult for them to transition to a 4-3-3 if they need to during the match. I seem to remember they did it at Celta Vigo a few weeks back, mid-game, so I don't think the diamond is something they're going to move away from to begin with, but Ancelotti is not the type of guy who is just going to pick a formation and stick on it if he sees that there are solutions to be found by doing something else. He'll happily switch. For this one, we've talked about him a lot already, and if he carries on like this, we'll end up talking about him every podcast. But Bellingham is the guy in Spanish football at the moment. He's gone away with England, looked brilliant against Scotland the other night, totally decided the game again, and it felt like actually that Ancelotti had tapped into something with him, just in respect of how he plays for England, because England played Declan Rice and Calvin Phillips in midfield with him in pretty reserved roles, and just had Bellingham ahead and said, you have total freedom, make things happen, win the game for us. And that's exactly what he did. So Bellingham, it feels like, has transformed from a guy who came to Spain as a number eight, box-to-box midfielder, and now he's basically just a conquering opposition half player. So interested
to
see.
It's funny that you say about Ancelotti tapping into something. Just thinking here out loud, when he went to Everton, Dominic Calvert-Lewin went on this incredible run of goal scoring, and I remember at the time they were saying, "Oh, Ancelotti just told him to take less touches, just shoot on sight. Just one touch goal," and he scored a load of goals, got himself into the England team. And then one of the biggest criticisms of Vinicius when he came in was that wild in front of goals, liable to do anything. Ancelotti came in, and if I remember correctly, Vinicius started to finish a lot better and started to actually score goals. Bellingham too, he's come in and he had that part of his game again, and he had that part of his game already, but now it seems like he's gone to another level with his goal scoring, being in the right place at the right time. They're scrappy goals. They haven't, none of them have really been incredible finishes, but just in the right place at the right time. Is that something that Ancelotti does? Because we always talk about Ancelotti as some kind of a guru in terms of getting into his player's head, being nice and relaxed, stuff like that. Is that something, do you think, that he has done with Bellingham? Because Bellingham, aside from just being unbelievable, I think the shock or the talk around Bellingham right now is just how surprised we all are as to how confident he looks. I mean, he goes to Real Madrid and he doesn't shrink in the jersey. He just looks like this is where he belongs and has always belonged. And I just think that Ancelotti's probably tapped into something there with that, and him playing as a more further forward, it's a perfect combination of coach and player who's willing to do it.
Yeah, I keep thinking, is this merely a hot streak at the start of a career? Because he's, like we said, he's deciding games every week. He's done it for club and country so far this season. What is it? Six games, six goals, two assists. A number of those have decided the match in terms of a result directly. So I'm kind of just thinking no matter how good he is, how well he's playing, the role, his comfortability in it, how long can he actually keep this up? Because he's still the guy who is chasing back 60 yards and making slide tackles in the defensive half. So it's like he's controlling every part of a game pretty much at this point. And yeah, I'm just intrigued to keep watching and see how long this having such a tangible effect on the result is going to last. So yeah, we'll see.
But this is the thing, Jamie. He, like, when Ronaldo stopped scoring goals, you're looking going, okay, he could get this, a couple of assists or whatever. Not a couple, he got a lot. But once Ronaldo's goals dried up, or if he went through a spell, it was like, this is what he lives. This is who he is. This is his identity. Bellingham's identity is so much more. He's everything. And even if the goals stop, he still adds massive value. And this, I think, is what makes him so dangerous to play against. Because even when the goals aren't coming, even when the defense is sitting back and blah, he does all the other stuff. And you're right. They are eventually going to dry up. He's not going to decide every game over the course of a 38-game season, plus Champions League, plus Copa del Rey, whatever. But he does everything. And he doesn't mind, okay, the shots aren't arriving today, there's no space in the box. I'll sit out back and I'll just pick the defense apart. And he's just so dangerous in every aspect of play.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I feel like I could do the podcast on Bellingham. But
I know.
He's just astounding so far. But yeah, I guess we could talk about just looking at the week that Real Madrid have got coming up. It's Real Sociedad at the weekend, then Union Berlin, then Atletico Madrid. It's a pretty demanding week, so it's probably the first chance we're going to see for Ancelotti to really show us what his thinking is in terms of rotation. Obviously, we know Kroos is... I'm intrigued to see, will Ancelotti still lean on him when the huge games come around, because he's such a controlling effect and he takes charge. Modric clearly wants to play more, so... Do you reckon this is a week where Ancelotti is going to show his cards a little bit?
Yeah, I'd say this is probably the one thing that we're going to be paying most attention to this week in terms of who's rested, where they're playing who. And I think on the Modric and Kroos thing, it's kind of funny because you think, oh, this is great. Real Madrid have brought in their succession plan, Tchouameni, Camavinga, players like that, and you were expecting Modric and Kroos to fall off and just to accept their fate, but they're not going silently into the dark night. They're still playing, and Modric has earned the right to play when he's fit and he's good. So when he's playing well, and I mean, he's still going strong. So it is a task for Ancelotti to both keep Modric happy and Kroos happy, while also making sure that Tchouameni and Camavinga don't stagnate. So everything has made sense in terms of their succession plan, squad planning. But what doesn't make sense is how long Modric and Kroos keep going. So yeah, we're going to have to see. And like I said, this is when the business ended. This is business now with Champions League and rotation. And this is when we see what... Like Bellingham, for example, the only thing I can see that can slow him down right now is fatigue or something like that. So we'll just see how that evolves, because we talked about Frenkie de Jong. I said Barcelona are a Frenkie de Jong injury away from complete crisis. You could also argue that Real Madrid are one Jude Bellingham knock away from their whole attack, their whole identity collapsing in on top of them.
I was just thinking about players who might come in beyond Kroos and Modric. If Bellingham went out, it would maybe open the door for Brahim Diaz, because I remember reading in the summer that there were these articles coming out from like AS and Relevo saying Brahim Diaz has been promised an important role this season. He's going to play a lot. And it's like, I'll believe that when I see it. Is he going to play this week? How much is he going to play? Arda Güler is injured now. So if Brahim doesn't really have a role in this week, you know, managing European games, then yeah, when is he actually going to feature?
Yeah, I often wonder about players that are told certain things and you're looking going, and obviously we're not privy to what is said or what promises are made, but sometimes you're looking going, this isn't happening. It's, you know, and I know Brahim has to back himself and all that, but like, you just wonder, man, you need to go somewhere. You're 24 now. You need to go somewhere where you're going to be playing 2,000 minutes, and you're not getting those minutes at Real Madrid. So you just wonder, he's backed himself to go in and take the chance he gets, but the chances are going to be so slim, and it's going to take a lot to knock Rodrigo and or Vinicius or Bellingham. I mean, practically impossible to knock them out of the starting 11. So you just have to kind of live on scraps. But moving on then to Real Sociedad, who have possibly one of the toughest run of games in their next three games. Real Madrid, Champions League semi-finalists, storied team, one of the most historic clubs in the world. Inter Milan, Champions League finalists last year, competing for Serie A every year. And then the dreaded Getafe at home. what a run of games. Like, you rest players for Real Madrid. No, you can't do that. Inter Milan, no, that's not easy. Getafe, okay, this is going to be an absolute war. So Real Sociedad, we're going to find out what they're made of this week too.
Yeah, this is the test for Real Sociedad. We know domestically they're very good. If they only have to concentrate on La Liga, I would back them to finish fourth this season all day long. But the difficulty is in, they've qualified for the Champions League. That's where they want to be. And they want to be competitive once they're there. So managing the squad for Alguacil between Europe and the league is the big challenge. And it will come down to whether they've got enough, because full credit to Real Sociedad, you can argue whether it's the optimal thing or not, but they really trust their academy players and young players to step into roles that they just wouldn't get at other similar sized clubs, I don't think. So you've got Beñat Torrientes is basically next man in line after Mikel Merino now. So if Merino gets an injury, a huge player for the team, represents a lot, then you've got Torrientes coming in, who has basically only played in Segunda and in the third tier for the club so far as a regular player. So yeah, this is the test for Real Sociedad, and you'd really like to hope that it goes well for them.
And they played most recently Granada. One of the things that Imanol Alguacil has done for this Real Sociedad side is made them one of the best defences in the league. But as we spoke about, they have to trade off a little bit of that by getting their fullbacks more involved, which they have done. Brought in Traore, who's way more, gets forward way more often. And Tierney, obviously, they made two changes for that Granada game from the game prior to that against Las Palmas. And they conceded three goals. Is that something you would worry about with this team? Because prior to that, they'd only conceded two goals in their first three games, and then they went and conceded three against Granada, newly promoted Granada. Is that going to be a trade-off that they're just going to have to accept? They're going to concede more goals, they're going to concede more chances with more attacking fullbacks.
I think that game was a bit of an anomaly, really. Watching it back, I didn't feel like it was a 5-3 game. I felt like it could have easily been like 7-1 Real Sociedad. I think Granada are just a team who are going to invoke pretty chaotic games this season, and they'll probably come out on the worst end most of the time. But yeah, based on the performance, I thought it was really good from Real Sociedad. It looked like they were back to last season, or what they wanted to look like coming out of the gate this season. So yeah, I think that was the real start of their season now, and we'll see. Going to Real Madrid is obviously never easy, but they're a team who, or they were the only team that didn't concede a goal against Real Madrid in La Liga last season, unbeaten across both games. So yeah, they, for a team who wants to keep pushing and always improving and being more and more able to go to teams like Real Madrid and get a result, then yeah, it's another step, and we'll see where they're at.
But they're going to have to figure out their attack, because they played that game against Granada without any other centre forward options. Umar Sadiq, Carlos Fernandez, or Andre Silva. Andre Silva is still injured. And it's actually quite hard to find out what actually is wrong with him, because it's not really clear as to what is going on there. He's still not training with the first team, still training on his own, doing his own work. Umar Sadiq coming back from that ACL injury in August of last year, but that's been 13 months now, so you'd be thinking he's going to have to start in these games. And obviously Take Kubo, who, if Lamine Yamal is the man at the moment. Kubo's certainly, or well, sorry, Bellingham too, but Kubo's right up there with a player who people are starting to talk about and take notice of, and this has become his team. He's back, he's going back to Real Madrid where he started, or where he was at Barcelona, but he was at previously with Real Madrid, and one of the most interesting storylines of this weekend, and they're going to have their hands full with him.
Yeah, I was just going to say, we'll see in the game itself, but Kubo going back to the Bernabeu, I don't know why, I was just knowing the form that he's in and how well he's playing, what it means for him to go back there and play. It reminded me of Chukwueze for Villarreal last season, you know, where there was this young winger who had been playing well, making a difference a lot, and then he went to the Bernabeu and had one of those games where it's like, right, I'm here now. I've just decided a game at the Bernabeu against Real Madrid. Coming inside, whipping that winner into the top corner. It was like, yeah, that's a performance that puts you on the map after you've shown promise leading up to it. So, yeah, not to apologies to Real Madrid fans, not to say that I hope you lose this weekend, but a Kubo, a real stand-up performance would be really nice to see.
Yeah, and it would also kickstart their season properly. They had a couple of draws. At the first 3 weeks of the season, a few draws actually, and then beat obviously Granada. Then we were saying, and if Kubo could go into the Bernabeu and light it up, that would really kickstart their season. Gives them so much confidence going to that Inter Milan game, and yeah, that's probably going to be the game of the week. Moving on then to Atletico Madrid, who play Valencia, Lazio, and then Real Madrid at home, and. You Valencia are so young that you would feel like that this is the kind of game that Atletico Madrid will just win maybe 2-0, maybe 3-0, given how just stubborn and dogged they are under Simeone. And then Lazio under Maurizio Sarri, and they've been surprise package in Serie A last year, certainly, and we'll see what they're made of this season. But Rodrigo De Paul reported to return from international duty with an injury. That would be a big loss. But what you're interested most in is Pablo Barrios's involvement over a fairly demanding week. He has been basically in playing in place of Koke now, but he's not going to start all three of those games. Who do you think is going to play in place of him, or do you think he maybe plays the majority of those minutes?
Yeah, the one I'm looking at for Barrios especially is the Madrid derby. Will Simeone, he's given him the Koke role for now, but when it comes to the big game, will he trust, you know, the young guy in that position? But looking at the squad, I think it's really only Witsel that could come in for him at this point with Koke injured as the, you know, the midfielder that sits closest to the defense. So yeah, we mentioned that DePaul's come back with an injury reportedly. It's not certain yet that he's out for this weekend, but with this Atletico side, it makes me nervous every time they lose one of those key individuals that have played so well this summer. This summer and this year as a whole, pretty much. So yeah, we saw with Molina, he started the season injured, and I felt they missed a lot just for having him missing. He's looked brilliant since they've come back. If they lose De Paul now, even just for a game, it still makes me a little bit nervous in terms of keeping Atletico right in the mix for the title this season.
Yannick Carrasco was obviously signed by Al Shabab in the Saudi Pro League, so he's gone. The post Yannick Carrasco era starts, and Samuel Lino is injured, so he's not going to play, or at least he's training just on the margins. They're kind of waiting to see if he, as they say in Spain, they're waiting on his evolution. So does that mean that Javi Galan plays minutes? I mean, this is what he was signed for, no? To step in for Carrasco and to add depth when they need it.
Surely, yeah. He, you know, leading up to joining Atletico, we all knew him as probably one of the best five left-backs in La Liga. Had been consistent season upon season at Celta, so he's not a player you sign and then just stash on the bench and play occasionally. You would imagine that it was a signing made knowing that there was a good possibility that Carrasco would leave. And yeah, with I do think Carrasco leaving is actually quite a big blow. I know they've got Galan that they're lined up, but for Carrasco, much better 1v1 dribbler than Galan, I would say. I mean, the numbers might say otherwise in terms of per 90, but in terms of playing the ball out wide and him facing a defender up, I would much rather have Carrasco doing that. Just for the fact of angles as well, because when Carrasco faced the defender up, he could cut in and shoot very comfortably, whereas Galan is probably going to have to go on the outside of his defender and put a cross in. So just for the fact of having a right footer on that left-hand side, as long as he held defensively, then he was a massive attacking weapon. And I'm not sure Galan will... I think he'll struggle to get to quite that same importance going forward.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that Carrasco is the kind of player who we're probably going to look back and think, oh, we didn't realize how important he was until he was gone. Because... And he's always, it always felt like he was on the brink of leaving. Every single transfer market, there was talk that he was about to leave. And it felt like, I mean, he had left like 3 or 4 times already, and he finally does move now. So we're going to see what exactly Simeone does without him. And a solid start to the season from them. So I guess part of how Atletico Madrid will gain an advantage here in La Liga is A, by being consistent throughout the season, as Barcelona and Real Madrid maybe put more of their eggs into the Champions League basket, and they maybe suffer with their depth, and Atletico Madrid just need to stay consistent. So 3 big games for them coming up, and we're going to see what they're made of and what their squad depth is like now with Carrasco gone and Rodrigo potentially injured. And then finally, we're going to talk about Sevilla now, who play Las Palmas, Lens, and Osasuna. Did I say that right, Jamie? You're French.
Lens, yeah.
Pronunciation. Oh, Lens. What did I say? Lens.
I think it's Lens, yeah.
Yeah, they've got a shop here in Spain. It's called Carrefour. It's like, but it's French. But we've got a French friend, and she says, like, she laughs when we say Carrefour, because she's like, no, it's not that. It's Carrefour. I'm like, ah, listen, I'm just going to stay with Carrefour. And croissant, too, is like croissant. Anyway, moving on to more important matters. Sergio Ramos is back at Sevilla, and Mendilibar, Jamie, I'm sorry, I'm an optimistic kind of guy. I like to think of myself as an optimist, but this does not look good for Jose Luis Mendilibar.
What, in terms of the Ramos signing itself, or just...
not the signing, not just in general. I started with Ramos, we'll talk about him, but just in general, like, I don't think Sergio Ramos, you could, 10 Sergio Ramos in their prime, I don't think could help Mendilibar at this stage. It looks like they're playing Las Palmas at home at the weekend. If they lose this, they're bottom of the table, and where do they go from here?
Yeah, it's pretty much close to a must-win game. I would say that one. If Sevilla did actually lose that game, I'd still be surprised if they did, but you'd have to think Mendilibar would be in quite close to sack territory there. And it's something I've thought with Victor Orta coming in this summer as well, a guy who I know pretty well from many years at Leeds. I don't think he's a guy who would pick Mendilibar under any circumstances to manage a team that he's overseeing. He likes to build a project with a younger manager with a bit more of an outside name. At Leeds, you know, he had Bielsa, who he went for, and then he went for a very, very idealist, you know, Red Bull style of football with Jesse Marsh. So he's quite a maverick, I think, and I'm not sure Mendilibar really floats his boat. Obviously, he's not going to say that explicitly, but I think when the time comes, Orta will have quite a short leash with Mendilibar. So he's a guy who has to win starting this weekend. And looking at their Champions League group as well, they're in it with Arsenal, Lens, and PSV. So besides Arsenal, that is a group you would expect Sevilla to really have a good chance of getting out of. And Yeah, if they struggle in that, they play Lons at home first. So if they get off to a bad start, then they're immediately on the back foot. So it's a really big week for Sevilla. And they've got a few new faces that have come in. Luki Bakio came in from Germany. They've got Sumare on loan from Leicester. So I don't know too much about Luki Bakio, but it feels like they're trying to freshen up as much as they can before the end of the window shut, because they knew the dynamic needs to change in some way. Obviously, Ramos is a name that does that in itself.
Yeah, I obviously switched off during that transfer market because, yeah, they've signed a right good few players. They signed Gabriel Sow from Frankfurt, Loic Badet, who had been made permanent. He was on loan the previous season. Yeah, Luke Bacchio, Pedrosa, obviously Sergio Ramos, Mariano Diaz, who we haven't seen playing football in a while, but he used to get goals anyway. He went to Lyon and scored a boatload of goals then, and then signed with Sevilla. And yeah, on the Arta thing, we spoke after Mendilibar had won the Europa League with Sevilla last season, and we were just saying, listen, this is the emotional, this is the right decision to make, because he's earned this, and you have to kind of stay going with it. But it does feel like, it always did feel like, as soon as they started hitting a little bit of turbulence, things could go south, and it they haven't started well at all. And like it feels like this is a really good job for anyone. They're in the Champions League. They've got, I don't know about the squad in terms of, there is a lot of players there that are kind of like probably not good enough to be starting on a Sevilla team that is competing at the top end of La Liga. But it's not a bad squad, especially with those new additions, and there is a lot of depth there. And so it's a really good job for someone, and I'd say there'd be a lot of people lining up to take this job if it ever did become available. But then just on Sergio Ramos, finally, what do you make of this? Is he going to start? Is he going to play? Is he going to have an impact?
I think one benefit that will come immediately from the off is, I think it taps into Sevilla being a pretty emotional team. I think under Mendilibar, they're at their best when there is emotion and they've got characters in the team like Ramos. You think back to when Eibar finished ninth in La Liga under Mendilibar, which is obviously a massive achievement. They had La Liga veteran fans will know this, but they had Ivan Ramis in defence, who was probably one of the slowest centre-backs I've ever seen in La Liga. But he was brilliant for them. And the debate on Ramos will be, you know, does he have the legs? Can he play in a team that press from the front, and is he up at the halfway line all the time? But I think Mendilibar views it as, if I've got a slow defender, I'm going to play even higher and just try and cut everything off at source and not have to run back in the first place. So it worked with Ramis over the course of a season, and Ramos is older than Ramis was back then, but he's a much better athlete than he was. So Ramos is a guy who was, he didn't quite fill the stadium, but loads of people came out just to see the guy holding a shirt up and do some kick-ups. So the more emotion that I think Sevilla can pour into their team with the players and the makeup of the squad that they've got, I think it's a good thing. And yeah, we'll see in time, but I would imagine Mendilibar would rather have Ramos than not.
Yeah, so basically what you're saying is that they're just basically running on vibes now at this stage. And I do agree. I know that you're not saying that, but I think that a lot of Mendilibar's style works in certain settings. It works perfectly because once you win, like Manchester United, for example, in the Europa League, there's the second leg in at the Ramon Sanchez Pizjuan. That was just, they put De Gea under a bit of pressure at the start, put Maguire under a bit of pressure, and all of a sudden it was like they were playing with 13 men. And yeah, but in games where a team is sitting back and not really wanting the ball and stuff, then Mendilibar's style, he needs to kind of come out and not be as dogmatic with his approach. But I just kind of like to set the end thing. there comes a point where that actually starts to hurt you, and it can help in a lot of senses. I mean, Mendilibar has had an amazing career as a manager at the top level, but there is a time when it caps your ceiling for you, when you can't switch and change and be a little bit more flexible. But yeah, Sevilla have the Las Palmas, Lens, and Osasuna, so really tough one for them. Sorry, yeah, I didn't say Osasuna before, but Osasuna away from home, I mean, that's gonna be tough, and Mendilibar is gonna either come out the other end of this, or else he's going to come out under serious pressure. But I think that pretty much wraps it up for what we wanted to talk about here. We're going to be back next Tuesday talking about the games that we just discussed and La Liga, but also the champion. We're going to preview the Champions League. We've got a special guest on to talk about Union Berlin and things of that nature. So, but from here on La Pausa Pod for this episode, it's adios.